Welcome to the Scene Gene podcast. I'm Deanna Abadi, director of the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. The Scene Gene podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies and the Arab American National Museum. Joining us today is Mas'oud Hayoun. Mas'oud is the Arab American Book Award winning author of When We Were Arabs, The Jewish Family's Forgotten History. The book is both a decolonial memoir of his grandparents who raised him and are co-authors of the book, as well as a political theory of Arabness and belonging. Mas'oud is also an award-winning investigative journalist who has reported internationally for outlets including Al Jazeera, Agence France-Presse, and CNN. He lives in Los Angeles. And today we're going to talk about his book, which won the Arab American Book Awards in 2020, When We Were Arabs, A Jewish Family's Forgotten History. And this is your first book. I want to welcome you, Mas'oud. I want to say I'm really excited and a little giddy because you are someone I like very much and one of my favorite people, even though we've only recently met and gotten to know each other. In fact, we met in 2019 when you came to Detroit to do a reading at Sourcebooks. I think it was co-sponsored by the museum and I introduced you to the audience. We spent sort of that weekend together kind of getting to know each other. And I think I took you around Dearborn and we had a very good lunch at the Syrian restaurant. And so, yeah, it was one of my favorite.
And Coffee at Kahwa House.
Coffee at Kahwa House, of course. Yeah. So, yeah, I just want to say, you know, welcome. And I hope you've been doing well these past few months. I think we're going to start with an excerpt from your book that you've chosen. Maybe you can tell us a bit about your book, When We Were Arabs, just briefly, and why you chose this particular excerpt.
As you said, it's both a decolonial memoir of my grandparents and hopefully a political theory of Arabness and of belonging and, I would say, Arab liberation. I started writing it together with my grandmother. We kind of embarked on a project to get a book contract. Beginning, I would say, in around 2014, around the time of the Israeli offensive in Gaza, that we wanted to tell this story to the world, not as a Palestinian story, but to kind of situate ourselves in ongoing current events. And then beyond that, in ongoing conversations that people are having in academia and around the world about what constitutes Arabness. So I'm just reading an excerpt from the beginning of the book. The very beginning is where there's a lot more of the political theory. And then I use that to go into kind of an abstract exploration of my grandparents, their lives, the lives that came before through the lens of colonialism and through what I take to have been their Arabness. I identify as Arab because reclaiming my place in a broader Arab world, an aspirational Arab world in solidarity with itself, scares our foes who have for so long taught us to fight against ourselves. I am an Arab because that is the legacy I inherit from Daida and Oscar. It is how they remain for me immortal. My Arabness is cultural. It is African. My Arabness is Jewish. It is also retaliatory. I am Arab because it is what I and my parents have been told not to be for generations, to stop us from living in solidarity with other Arabs.
Thanks for reading that. I'm glad you started with this selection because it's one that I had also underlined in when I was reading your book. I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit more about this idea of Arabness, especially since in more recent days, it's been sort of under this term Arab has been under a lot of scrutiny. It's kind of been seen as an exclusionary term, yet you don't see it that way.
Absolutely. I was very surprised, I think, in the production of this book to find that so many non-Jewish Arab people were also struggling with the term Arab and to kind of ask myself why the people I was speaking with were struggling with that term. Obviously, to identify with any kind of identity, as we've discussed before, is a social construct. People can ascribe to an identity or they can deny it. Part of the kind of conclusions of the book that I arrived at discussing the Arab identity, both with Jewish and non-Jewish Arab people in the reportage that resulted in it, impressed upon me the degree to which Arabness is a choice to identify with what Nawal al-Sa'dawi, who recently passed away, termed the Arab peoples. And that part, I think, is central to the way that I tell the Arabness that I experience in Oscar and Daida and myself. It is a choice. It is both a political choice. It is something that is essential in the sense that it's a legacy that I hold on to because it reminds me of my family, even where I don't have family anymore. But the choice element is extremely important. The questions then became in looking at different moments in their lives when Oscar and Deyda didn't identify with Arabness or were taught through policy documents that specifically enforced their not seeing themselves as Arab, to ask why. What about Arabness had become a slur to people who could have identified with this legacy that just before Oscar and Deyda's generation, people of every religious and simultaneous kind of identity were beginning to ask themselves, what is this Arab identity? What is belonging to our nations? What is belonging to peoples who in many cases don't look or eat or talk like me very much? And what is the potential for human liberation in identifying with this legacy? And then it also was impressed upon me that what you're talking about, the controversy that has arisen over people being able to identify with this legacy, is not reflected as much in other legacies, that it seems to be the Arab legacy for very particular, very cynical political objectives that's under assault. Those are the political objectives that I describe in the several echelons of imperialism that my grandparents lived in this book. And they are the political phenomena that I'm reacting to, that my family and all of the other Jewish Arabs who resulted in this work coming to be are reacting to, is why not Arab? That's the key question, I think, maybe the central question of when we were Arabs, why not Arab?
Mm-hmm. You talk about a sort of an aspirational Arab world in solidarity with itself. What is aspirational about it? So is it not the Arab world that exists today or an Arabness that exists today, but one that you would like to see kind of emerge or...
Yes and no. I don't believe in myself as somebody who was raised in the United States being somebody who should speak with authority on what should happen in the Arab world. And I think that from my friends in my community, in the Arab American community, there's oftentimes a desire, particularly among the writers and the journalists who I've known, to speak on our homelands as though we can speak better than people there for our homelands. And it is true to a degree that there are things that I'm allowed to say here that I'm not allowed to say in my homelands. There's some credence to that. But at the same time, there are realities that I haven't lived, particularly as somebody who was raised by parents from the Arab world who has gone back but never lived there for any significant period of time and never really known the realities of those people. That's not to say that it does, that it's not mine or that it's been formally divorced from me, but it's to say that I am not a leader. And I think that when we were Arabs, I'm always trying to gender when we were Arabs. I think I'm always talking about whether it's a more masculine or feminine enterprise because it came about with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a masculine or feminine enterprise to try to take ownership of something or try to have a conclusive answer about something. And I think that that's what was beautiful and matriarchal about Deyda and about this project is that I say up front in When We Were Arabs, I don't know. I don't know where my ancestors are from going far back. And good, I don't really need to know my DNA history to know that I identify with an Arab cultural legacy or ethnic legacy. I don't need absolute answers for anything. It is the Netanyahus of the world who need absolute answers for everything. It is the Trumps of the world who need absolute answers for everything. That's not my prerogative in this. It's to my mind, it's a more female. And I don't know whether it just furthers the patriarchy to say that female is more laid back or whatever, but it is a more female enterprise in my mind because it doesn't try to be the Amma that we've had in all of our families who knows the answers to the so-called Palestinian-Israeli conflict or whatever. I don't need to prove anything to anyone like most of the men that I've known in my life. And so I think When We Were Arabs is a female enterprise. I forgot where we started in this conversation. God bless it.
That's fine. I love a lot of things about this book. And I was very excited. I mean, like I said, when we first met in 2019, I was excited to meet you because I hadn't read the book yet, but of course had a copy of the book. And I was really intrigued about someone who identified as Arab and Jewish, was writing about sort of the history of his family and reinserting that history back into this larger Arab context, I think. What I love about the book is how you sort of weave together the colonial enterprise to de-Arabize Jewish Arabs and divorce them from their homeland, from their context, and to convince them that they're more part of this transnational Jewish nation or people rather than Tunisian or Arab or what have you, Egyptian. And I have to say the material evidence you provide is quite impressive to sort of lay out that story. But it's also the story of your family, and particularly your grandparents, Oscar and Daida, and also how those policies and strategies, you know, directly impacted their lives. I mean, to the point where they meet in Paris because they had to leave their respective homelands. Daida had to leave Tunis. Oscar had to leave Egypt. And by extension, it's your story also. You mentioned at the beginning why you wrote this. The Israeli war in Gaza in 2014 sort of compelled you to do this. But did you always intend to write it this way as a sort of, I'm telling the history of this colonial enterprise through the history of my family? Or was it more like family history that turned into a, you know, research and a historical account? Maybe if you could talk a bit about how you wrote the book.
Absolutely. First, I want to say meeting you and seeing the museum and being in Dearborn at the tail end of the book tour was the only bright point of a time when I was still in mourning very much. The way that this book came together, and this answers the question, is that I had struggled with my grandmother for several years to get somebody who wanted to tell this kind of story with us to offer us a contract. 3 months into the creation of When We Were Arabs, which was meant to be a lot more of a joint effort between me and an octogenarian matriarch who was very wry and witty and lucid until her dying day and really my best friend. That threw me into a tailspin. I mean, I had always envisioned that this book would be a mix of reportage and memoir and looking anecdotally at the psychology of these two colonized and uncolonizing people. And that it was meant to be very abstract in looking at that which was supposedly Arab about their lives and our lives before, and that which was colonized and tying threads together between what happened in North Africa and then what happened in occupied Palestine. And part of that was a function of me enjoying kind of abstract cinema ever since. I studied abroad in China and then worked there as a journalist and had a coming of age there and saw all of these bootleg new wave French films for the first time and kind of loved the idea that you can play with form the way that new wave films played with form and wanted to do something that was very abstract and weird. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother believed in that too, even though she wasn't a big fan of that particular kind of movie or thinking. So when she died, it became more of like a dirge. It became more of like a mourning this bygone world of my grandparents. And then through that, looking at something that a lot of other Arab American authors who are from less contested kind of corners of the Arab American community often look at, and that is longing for the past, having the past inform the future. I mean, we're in Passover right now, and I don't know if it's just Jewish Egyptian people, but we always have this custom that we say, where are you coming from and where are you going? And it's like a game that we play and people say where they want to go on vacation or something like that next year. And it's related to the Passover story of leaving Egypt. And it must have been very strange for these people who lived in and loved Egypt to talk about leaving Egypt. So kind of they were very spatially challenged people, as I imagine them. And so this idea of where you're coming from and where you're going is something that I see as a theme in Arab American literature of the past influencing the future. The book really very much did become all of that kind of shakshuka of like different elements. And then on top of that, overlaying it was the realization that I care about being Arab. A lot of the reason why is because I don't have family in the United States. We don't really talk to our family. We have a little bit of family left in North Africa. We have some family that long lost family in occupied Palestine. We have some family in France. I don't know them. It's just me and my mother on the edges of what we've been taught in our colonized minds is the map. On the farthest possible end in the far west, just two people who have no business being here, probably won't have any kids, we're the end of our family line. It can be very depressing and lonely. But if I meet somebody and they, I don't know, don't really eat couscous, but they still kind of, there's always something there about somebody, even from far away in the Gulf, thousands of miles away, that reminds me of how Oscar and Dida used to be. And it can be very little things. Like, I went to grad school with a reporter for an Egyptian state media. And I was at the time in my early 20s and kind of coming out of the closet and not really knowing a lot about myself. And she took care of me. And I got contact lenses because I thought I was making myself real beautiful. And she screamed at me in the middle of a student center, in the middle of everybody, in front of everybody, and said in French, "Tu vas te scanter les yeux. You're going to ruin your eyes. Why? Because you think that you're beautiful?" And that was such an Oscar thing to say. And everything that he used to say, he used to call me my eyes. Everything about my health was related to the eyes, poetically, for this man. And so for this woman to care and to say, "I love you," in a way that's a little aggressive, and about my eyes and about my vanity and me not being such a fool, was really one of these kind of minute examples of how I have a lot of family. In reality, I have family, and that family, if we choose it, can span thousands of miles and an infinite amount of different kinds of different looking and acting people. And that's beautiful. And that's what ties us also beyond Arabness, beyond any kind of social construct, to humanity. I don't end up feeling like I'm alone in a hut with my mom on the edges of humanity when I'm at the Arab American Museum, or when I go to Dearborn Fresh and I see that there's little things that you thought don't exist anymore, because we've been taught from the time that we're little Jewish Arab people that who we were is gone. Mm-hmm. That if we look at those movies, you'll see a world that's dead. But there was really a lot about my family. And I think that part of, in addition to the assault on Gaza that happened in 2014, what happened was a lot of Arab Americans who I was working with at Al Jazeera America were saying little things about what their family does, that they, little manners that reminded me of my grandfather, who by then had been dead for a decade. And I thought were just like weird things that he said, or things that I found out when I went back to the Arab world that weren't just like random things that my family did or said. Like, I didn't know that Oscar really did speak a lot more Moroccan dialect of Arabic with his family in the home than I learned when I went to Morocco. And I heard people talking on the street saying these words that I thought, oh, maybe that's from Hebrew. But Oscar didn't speak Hebrew. Mm-hmm. He was told that that was a more endemic language to our family than it was.
I see, yeah. Can you tell me more about Oscar and Dida, who they were? And you mentioned this, you wrote the book with Dida. You spent many hours, days, I guess, talking about things. And unfortunately, she passed before she, I think you began the physical act of writing, if I understand correctly. They're both so vivid in the book. And I was really surprised to find out that Oscar died when you were 16 years old. My mother had early onset dementia when I was 18, 19, and I never got to know her as an adult. And I don't think I could write as vividly about my mother the way you do about Oscar. And I wonder, is it because, you know, you have those notebooks that you refer to in your book? Were you always sort of planning to write this, you know, book in a way, or this memoir, that you were kind of, I don't know, maybe subconsciously or unconsciously taking notes of Oscar? Just tell us about these two wonderful, wonderful people.
I think all of them, all of the above are true. I do think, just starting with a part of the question about how I was able to write Oscar vividly, absolutely. They wanted to tell their life stories. They had written several iterations of autobiography, and in a deeply psychological way, and we were talking about this before, but I always end up doctor filling my grandparents kind of anecdotally talking about why they do what they do. And they very much wanted to tell their story. Dida had several different iterations of autobiography written that I discovered after she died, rummaging through her stuff. Oscar had only written a set of three Price Club, what was then the Price Club, what's now Costco, notebooks. And I thought that those notebooks were the story of his life, but they end at my age right now, in my early 30s, in Egypt. It was very much kind of a symbol of how he was in the United States. His life always kind of continued on in an Egypt of the mind. We were always in the car driving out to far away Anaheim, if you know Los Angeles, from the valley to Anaheim is just kind of a trek, to buy the exact kind of cheese it would take to make Sambusik the way how it was when he was little, or to buy a cassette from some really random Lebanese Armenian place in Glendale to be able to listen to Abdel Wahab while he did it, while we ate it. It was that they wrote that. It was also that my mother, who really did sacrifice all of the good parts of being a mother to supporting me in a very kind of viciously capitalistic society that doesn't look kindly on single mothers, told me in the moments when we were able to talk about where we were from, when we had our very little time together that we did because she worked weekends as well, write their story. And we didn't know, and she told me that from the time I was very little, write their story. She knew I liked to write, and that was what she wanted. And then another kind of reason for me being able to write Oscar when he died when I was 16 was that I have spent my entire life searching for this man. And I hope to never stop searching for this man. Every time I take a trip anywhere, it's to places that he was, finding this man. I was listening to a Janis Joplin song today. I was taking a long walk, and me and my Bobby McGee, she said, I would trade all of my tomorrows for a single yesterday. And that's how I feel about Oscar. I would trade every single day of my life just to have one more day. As an adult, as you say, it's just, I didn't appreciate anything that he was talking about. There was a moment where we were going to like stamp conventions together and he was trying to teach me Arabic and we were watching all these movies and we would have really vibed. I think that we would have really enjoyed each other's company if we were able to like have a coffee and talk about how the world is so messed up right now. So that's why I was able to write him well. And then in terms of who Oscar and Dida were, that's a real complicated question. I think that they were people I didn't know existed before I started writing this book, which is to say I didn't really know them until they died, unfortunately. And I think Dida was on the process of beginning to understand so much about herself before I was able to actually make requests at local libraries for hard to get documents in French and in Hebrew that would describe who she was and who decided how she was. Mm-hmm. I always thought that Oscar was more willing to culturally and ethnically identify with an Arab legacy than Dida. And I thought that was a function of pretension. I honestly thought that Dida was the kind of person who, when you came into her home, and this was a very Arabi thing actually, but it was affected in her what she thought of as French manners, to offer people little cakes when they came, and there were things that were only for guests, and there was in the niche the dishes that we never used for anyone, and they had little pictures.
Sounds like my parents.
Exactly. That's why it's a very Arab American thing. It's a weird post-colonial complex that makes people like this, but it was decided for her that she wouldn't identify very strongly at different moments in her life with a Tunisian or an Arab ethnic and cultural and political legacy. And I think that ultimately it was the fact that she was watching the news while I was working in the news and seeing what was happening to babies and mothers and men, that she decided that this was important enough to tell. There is a particular kind of person who just finds very interesting and novel that there are Jewish people who at their bar mitzvahs and weddings have a belly dancer there and serve arak and dance to Amadiyah. That part of my existence doesn't interest me as much as the political kind of potential for seeing oneself in solidarity with other people. I ended up making a mistake, one of many, at the book tour when I was in Los Angeles. I wanted to have a party because I hadn't left the house for a very long time, because after Dida died, I had a hard time leaving the house. And I cooked really just a ton of our traditional foods. And I think that set the wrong tone for the book, because people thought that I was trying to do this kind of commodification of our culture in a way that I wasn't. I just wanted to, and I'd like for anybody who was there to hear this, I hope they're listening, I wanted to celebrate, and I wanted to be hard on myself like Dida was hard on herself. because I know that if she was serving people, she would have served them too much. And she would have said that that was the Arab culture, to serve people too much food. And I did. I served people too much food and they liked it. It was okay. She wouldn't have liked it. She would have had something to say for sure.
I know, from reading about her life, she also had a very kind of contained life. Like her parents pulled her out of school when she was very young. Was it also just a factor of her experience growing up in Tunisia that she wasn't interacting with people who were not Jewish or in the area that she, her neighborhood, or am I misreading her life story?
No, that's an incredibly important facet of her life, is that, and it's a facet of her life that we wanted to tell and that we were reticent to tell for several reasons. When you tell a story about an Arab woman in the United States, it can work against liberation. If you talk about the very real women's rights issues that she faces, especially in the English language, and especially because Nawal Sa'dawi died, I'm very confident, I mean, with all of the caveats about her latter-day support for various things that hurt people in feminist and human rights movements, I'm very conscious, because of Nawal Sa'dawi, about when we write in English about gender issues, particularly because we know that when France and Britain occupied our homelands, they weaponized questions of minority and gender, minority rights and gender parity. And when they themselves, and we see until today, were incredibly misogynistic societies, just trying to project their version of misogyny onto our civilization. We ended up wanting to tell the story of her parochial kind of life, and that was, which was misogynistic about her upbringing, to counter a trend of Islamophobia that exists in our societies today, and to show that it is a function not of the Arab culture, but of the time that she was being raised in, that people, without needing to couch it in some kind of a semblance of progressivism, were deeply misogynistic, regardless of whether you were Jewish or Muslim in Tunisian society, as in French society. And there was a kind of misogyny that made itself manifest in her French education as well. So we hopefully showed no one has a monopoly on misogyny. With the Me Too movement, we know that there are echelons of assault and violence against women and femme people that's been happening that we didn't know to be happening at all. So it really is quite ridiculous for people to look at the Arab peoples and to say, you really are misogynistic. I mean, this is the first time with you telling me this, but it's the first time that I thought about the role that our parochialism and the role that Daida, being a so-called bint Nes, would have played on her not asking herself these questions from the jump. Yes, there was an element that was decided for her by people across the Mediterranean. It was also decided for her by members of our family who decided that a woman who ended up having rather radical revolutionary socialist tendencies would be beholden to the kitchen and to the washing for her brothers, and that she would be a kind of a maid for her family, even in France. Our family was so tied to Tunisia that my grandmother, up until she ended up leaving Tunisia, never envisioned a trip beyond the borders of Tunisia. Tunisia is a very small country. The idea of going to Algiers for my grandmother was out of the question. It was crazy because of prejudices against Libya, and also because we were divided by the linguistic border made by the fact that they were Italian occupied and we were French occupied. It was even more unthinkable that she would ever venture, not very far really, just a kind of a short day trip to Libya. And then also because we had certain kind of stereotypes of Libya being a backwater, including their Jewish communities, that were very unfair and untrue and kind of blind to Libyan civilization. So yes, very much that is so true, that the fact that my grandmother was not like some of the revolutionary, looser, for lack of a better term, women that I describe in this book, who were arrested for advocating for Tunisian liberation and for singing for faraway Syrian liberation and for seeing themselves as part of a Tunisian and a larger Arab universe. Mm-hmm. The fact that my grandmother was beholden to being a bint Nes made her have a longer journey towards certain realizations than people like the famous cabaret singer Habiba Masika. who wrapped herself in the Tunisian independence flag and was arrested by the French colonial authorities. My grandmother could have been the Joan of Arc. Of course, I look toward France for an example of the Tunisian people, if she had been allowed to, because she didn't have the kind of family who would allow her to spend time with the kind of social subversives who were anti-Bey and who met in the dead of the night in basements and frolicked and drank and did all kinds of what they would have considered like conservative Muslim Tunisian people to be shaitaniyat.
And I think also her sort of her upbringing and the time she spent in Tunis, as you said, very parochial, very sheltered in a way, is in stark contrast to Oscar's life. Sounds like he's a good time guy. Like he enjoys life. And of course, as a man, you know, in Egypt in those days, even now, has much more liberty to do, to go and to you know, enjoy himself and to live life. In my mind, it was always like, oh, well, that makes sense that Oscar is very much an Egyptian and you know, has a sense of his Arabness, because he's outside all the time and hanging out with friends who are Jewish or Coptic or even in, you know, in Alexandria, which is a much more international Mediterranean kind of cosmopolitan city. Your environment really does impact your identity. And it's not surprising that Daida, once she leaves Tunis, you know, it might have been a longer journey, but she does start to identify or see the similarities that Tunisians have with other Arabs. Maybe switching gears a bit, what's been the reception to your book from Arabs, from Jews, from other Jewish Arabs? Do you know, do you get a sense of how people are reading it, how they're sort of reacting to it?
It's a very interesting topic to me because, as you know, I love Dr. Phil kind of anecdotal psychology. I should have gone into another field. But there are people who, as expected, just absolutely hate it because they hate its politics or they can't vibe with how abstract it is, jumping from this chapter to the next, and the structure of it is just not for them. And that's fine and was anticipated. There are also people who say that they want to read it because they consider themselves to be progressive. And I really do appreciate people who say that they haven't read the book when they haven't read the book, or just don't tell me anything about the book, including among my friends. You don't have to read my book. We're still friends. It doesn't mean anything if you haven't read it. The only thing is, if you tell me that you've read it and I can tell that you haven't read this book because you assume that you know what When We Were Arabs would be about by reading the title and looking at the Orientalist little designs that they put on the front of the book. No, just don't do that to me. Just don't put me through that. It's awkward for us. I'm already awkward enough as it is. You just leave it. There are people who are Zionists who have put it on lists of Jewish memoirs that came out in 2019, 2020, clearly not because they read any of the contents, but are promoting it and saying that they like this book because they don't want to be called out for centralizing Jewish Ashkenazi or Eurocentric kind of Jewish experiences. Those people make me feel 2 feet tall. Just leave me off your list. Miss me. There are a lot of people from the non-Arab people who could choose Arabness, who are of the very Phoenicianist, Carthaginianist kind of set, a state of mind, to whom I would ask, I agree that Arabness is a choice, but you have to interrogate whether your opposition to Arabness is rooted in colonial era racism more than any kind of considered reading of history or politics, who have brandished this book without reading it for the purpose of supporting the normalization deals that Israel has undertaken, for the purpose of trying to brandish something that they assume will be against an Arabist, I would say ideology, but this is a very anti-ideology book if you read it. Those people are cut from the same cloth as the Zionists who brandish this book without reading that it is a deeply and first and foremost anti-Zionist work. I mean, I should say that the anti-Zionism isn't what is the most central about this book, because Palestinian stories are for Palestinian people to tell, but it is a little bit funny and a little bit embarrassing. I'm embarrassed for certain people who have claimed to read this book but clearly haven't. But by and large, a lot of people have read it and told me things about my family that I didn't even know. and told me things about their Arabness. I think that one of the most beautiful responses in this book, because this book was written for people who identify with this legacy, is that they tell me what constitutes Arabness for them. And that to me is empowering and informs my idea of Arabness going forward. To my mind, that's something that's beautiful. I think a lot of people flipping through the book noticed that the book was dedicated to our youth and thought that it meant to Jewish Arab youth. When if you read the rest of the book, you know absolutely that it is to the youth of the Arab peoples. It is not to a particular corner of the Arab peoples. The beauty of the Arab American community and the Arab American National Museum and the award that you bestowed upon me is that I, as a member of the most contested, one of the most contested corners of the Arab peoples, was allowed to ask myself, or empowered to ask myself, what is Arabness, in a way that allowed me to have a conversation with the greater Arab people, with many people from Arab countries who read English, who have told me, you know what, I take issue with Arabness for XYZ reasons. And if you do for XYZ reasons, I understand and I support you. That's been the reception. It's been all over the place. Some of it expected, some of it a little sad, and some of it mind-blowing. And the most beautiful parts, like the Arab American Book Award ceremony, were also, of course, a little heartbreaking because Zaida wasn't able to see it and Oscar wasn't able to see it. But I have emerged from my mourning in the sense that I'm able to be at peace with the fact that they do see, and have faith in the fact that God is gracious enough that I hope that they did see.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
I have one more question that I want to ask. It's about the chapter titles. They're either in Arabic or Hebrew or French, and you always include the English equivalent. I wanted to ask you, like, first of all, why did you do that? And why, for instance, is Exile in Arabic, but Darkness is in Hebrew and Rupture is translated into French?
This kind of is a little bit about my love of Louis Buñuel and this kind of abstract. I wanted it to be physically beautiful. Also, I needed to have Arabic language in the book to the extent that I could. These words, with maybe the exception of one, were words that I did know. And it is embarrassing to me and hurtful to me that I'm unable to write a book on the Arab peoples that is for the Arab peoples, and that I can only write it in English because I was a good kid, but not good enough to really absorb or take those lessons seriously. And Oscar and I loved each other very much, but we couldn't sit down at a table and have him teach me anything. It just wasn't our dynamic. The rest of the titles, the French and the Hebrew title, are more about underlining the blame for certain things through the use of language. Underlining why my family suffered a period of darkness in occupied Palestine. And saying, for instance, there are a great many people who, to counter in a really kind of mixed up logic, any kind of Palestinian claim to land, dignity, and life, say, well, a lot of Jewish Arabs were made refugees. They were made refugees by very specific early Israeli intelligence missions in our homelands that divorced us from our home societies. If any kind of reparations need to be paid to Jewish Arab people, it's by the Israeli government, first and foremost. And so that's the flaw in their logic. And I had hoped, using the Hebrew for darkness, to point that finger at them. La rupture, of course, is to point a finger at France, because they were the rupture that existed between us and our home societies. It is that language that I speak better than I speak Arabic, because people in French dignitary policy documents decided that I would ultimately forget my Arabness and identify more with the métropole than with my homeland. There was absolutely a role that was played in my family's exile by our homelands that has to be addressed. And that is very much the objective of this book, is that there are certain books that are exclusively about the pogroms and anti-Jewish hatred that our communities have suffered, that misread our histories, not just because it wasn't one continuous pogrom after the other, but also because the entire Arab world, regardless of whether you were Jewish, was suffering from questions of accountable government since time immemorial, and the same is true of the West. So you always find that those histories that fixate on eras of particularly draconian measures against the Jewish communities, ignore both draconian measures against all manners of Arab communities, including various Muslim communities, but that they ignore similar analogous circumstances in the West that were transpiring at the exact same time. And yet ours are teased out for the purpose of feeding into this illogic that Jews can be Russian and Jews can be Polish and French, but never fully, first of all. And Jewish Arabs simply don't exist because those are mutually exclusive identities.
There's so much to talk about in this book. I don't know if I've done it justice. I mean, the whole political aspect and whole journey of sort of de-Arabizing the Jewish Arab communities is just, you know, it was fascinating to read. But if there's anything that you would like to say before we kind of close this podcast. No pressure if you don't.
I definitely want to say, I know that I am a very kind of effusive person and that it was the greatest honor of my existence to get the Arab American Book Award for this book. It made my life. It made my life insofar as this entire book is about the love that I feel for where I'm from and for people from where I'm from, which is not to say that I love every single person of Arab origin who I meet, or to monodimensionalize Arab people. I have plenty of people who are not my friends and I wouldn't want to be, who are Arab or Arab American. The community, the museum, Dearborn itself are so powerful and centers of gravity in my life. And there's so much that's prescient about that space artistically, politically, culturally, that has continued to inform when we were Arabs, and that I hope they'll continue to be a conversation between the museum and when we were Arabs and my soul for eternity. That's all I have to say.
Well, I just want to say it's a well-deserved award. Your book is not only beautifully written, but a very important book, I think, sort of reinserting Jewish Arab history back into our history and reinserting that community back into this larger Arab community that we, as you said, we forget that they were a part of, you know, everyday life, part of this world. This, not to be nostalgic and sort of talk about the, you know, the golden days when everything was great, but I think, and they were not, but I think we've lost a sort of way of life in the Arab world, North Africa, the Middle East, that is really unfortunate, that richness and diversity just doesn't exist anymore. We've got a more homogeneous, I think, Arab population that makes us poorer, not richer. So I think your book is very important and will be an important book for a long, long time. So it was really a pleasure to read. Masrin, I want to say Yaishak. Thank you for joining us on the Seeing Jim podcast today and for sharing insights to your book, When We Were Arabs, A Jewish Family's Forgotten History, talking about Arabness, talking about your wonderful grandparents, Oscar and Dida, and about your sort of journey writing this book and what it has meant to you. So I want to thank you very much. And I thank everybody for listening.
Today's episode of the Seeing Jim podcast was hosted by Diana Abu Ali. It was produced by Asma Baban, Muhammad Jafar, and Maryam Rizet. It was edited by Muhammad Jafar with support from Eric Kiska. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdelhak. Seeing Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Seeing Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Ford Community Development Fund. Thank you for listening.